We'll hear argument first this morning in number 85-2156, Shari Tefila Congregation versus John William Cobb. Ms. Brannon, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case presents the issue whether a complaint that alleges racially motivated discrimination and harassment against Jews may state a claim under Title 42 of the United States Code, Section 1982. The complaint alleged that respondents' desecration of the synagogue of Shari Tefila Congregation was racially motivated and hence covered by the statute. The complaint further alleged that the facts that supported the allegation of racial motivation were principally the character, symbols, and words that respondents themselves painted on the synagogue. The complaint alleged that they painted the words "dead Jew," "death to the Jew." They painted swastikas, and on a door the words "in," "take a shower, Jew." They painted the garbled German words Totenkampfverband next to a skull and crossbones. The Totenkampfverbande were the death head units of concentration camp guards in Nazi Germany, and the skull and crossbones was their symbol. These words and symbols invoked Nazi ideology, and it was one of the principal tenets of Nazi ideology, both in Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s, and among neo-Nazi groups in this country today, that Jews are racially non-white and inferior to whites. The complaint further alleged that respondents painted the words Ku Klux Klan and the Burning Cross, the familiar symbol of the Klan. Klan groups, like the Nazis, hold as one of their central tenets that Jews are racially distinct from whites and inferior. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals split on the issue as to whether this conduct stated a Section 1982 claim. A majority affirmed the dismissal of the complaint, holding that because Jews are not racially distinct or non-white, this conduct does not state a 1982 claim. But in dissent, Judge Wilkinson recognized that although Jews are not racially distinct from whites, when they suffer racially motivated deprivation of rights protected by the statute, they, like any other group, should be covered. And we, of course, agree that Jews are not racially distinct from whites. We respectfully ask this Court to reverse the Fourth Circuit and to hold, consistent with its prior cases.
May I ask a question about your last comment? Do you think at the time the statute was passed that the people who voted for the statute thought that Jews were racially distinct or not?
I believe that they did, under the common understanding of the word race at that time. That issue has been briefed in greater detail, actually, in the St. Francis College case. For our purposes, we don't believe that that even would matter, that what really matters is that persons who discriminate against Jews, Arabs, or other minorities now, who do that because they view them as racially distinct, that that conduct should be covered. After all...
Well, maybe it should. But you don't contend that at the time the statute was passed, that the authors of the statute might well have used the term race in a way that would have treated the Jews as a separate race?
We believe that they did use that term at that...
But you don't rely on that fact.
We don't believe that that really adds to the argument that we're making. I'm reminded in answering your question of Justice Marshall's language in the McDonald case that at the time of the passage of the statute in 1866, Congress probably didn't anticipate racial discrimination against whites of the sort that this Court held in McDonald to be covered. But Congress had an open-ended concept of what it was covering, that there would be new groups coming to this country, new kinds of discrimination undoubtedly would arise. And it was the discrimination itself that Congress focused on, not particular groups and whether they were covered. That's also illustrated, we believe, in the legislative history by The repeated references to Germans and Swedes and other groups as a race who really it just isn't thought anymore that those groups are racially distinct.
The word discrimination, of course, connotes treating some people differently than others. Your idea is that the statute covers any instance in which, say, a Frenchman treats a German differently than he would another Frenchman if they're all in this country?
No, Justice Rehnquist, the principle for which we argue is more narrow. That would only be covered if it is racially motivated discrimination.
Well, and how does one know whether a decision by someone of French extraction to treat someone of German extraction differently than he would treat other people is racially motivated?
We think that that is a question for the finder of fact, as it would be in any...
Well, what should the judge charge the jury?
The judge should charge the jury that the standard is racial motivation and that that can be evidenced by statements and admissions of the defendants, by any, for instance, expert opinion, as we put in this case, that indeed this very conduct and these very symbols.
And if someone of French extraction then thought that a person of German extraction was of a different race, that would be sufficient.
Yes, it would, if it can be established. And the plaintiff, of course, has the burden of proof.
But only that this person thought that, not that it's a fact.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the reason...
But if you had discrimination of the same sort by a Frenchman against a German, just because he doesn't like Germans, they've been engaged in too many wars, and that other Frenchman acknowledges that they're not different races, then it wouldn't be actionable.
Unless the plaintiff could prove, of course, that that statement was false, that acknowledgement was false. And the reason we think that that is a principled and fair distinction, in fact supported by this Court's cases, is the Court has held that these statutes address discrimination that is racial in character. There is something especially invidious in the eyes of the 1866 Congress about racial discrimination. That if the discrimination were just for some other reason, it isn't of...
Why isn't it enough that he's discriminating against Germans? And Germans are a race under the statute.
Well,
he's discriminating against Germans as Germans. Not because he thinks Germans are a different race, but because he thinks Germans are Germans. And under the statute, as it was enacted at the time, it was agreed that Germans were a distinct race.
Wouldn't
that come within the statute?
That is another way of approaching the issue that we think is very fair in light of the legislative history, and indeed would lead to a reversal of this case and an affirmance in the St. Francis College case as well.
Would make a lot more sense, given two instances of discrimination against a German. You would want us to find one actionable and the other one not actionable, simply because one of the two people is foolish enough to think that Germans are a separate race and the other one isn't.
The only difficulty, as we have argued in our briefs, is that at all costs we would want the courts to avoid the issue of defining race in order to determine coverage. We believe that was one of the key errors of the Fourth Circuit majority, that they had a notion, a correct notion, that Jews are not racially distinct from white, and they let their correct idea get in the way of dealing with this discrimination on the terms of the discriminators themselves. And that certainly we wouldn't want the lower federal courts to be analyzing are Jews racially distinct, are Germans or Arabs or any other group racially distinct.
Well, unless that's what Congress intended to be determined in a case like this.
And we believe, Justice Rehnquist, that the legislative history demonstrates it's not at all what they intended, and that, in fact, this Court's analysis of that history in the McDonald case makes that very clear.
What if I take a dislike to people with brown eyes, and I say that I'm just not going to deal with people with brown eyes the same way I'm going to deal with people with blue eyes? If I deny someone a right on that basis, is that actionable under the statute?
The answer is, of course, unless it's racially motivated in our society.
Could that be racially motivated?
It could be if there were facts to show that historically or in our society and in the eyes of the discriminators it was a racial distinction. In the hypothetical.
But how is the judge going to charge the jury? What should they ask themselves to decide whether someone with blue eyes who treats differently people with brown eyes is, quote, discriminating, close quote?
That the charge should be whether it is conduct that we understand as racial, is based on that person and their heritage and background and what they are in unchangeable ways, unlike, for instance, religion. And that should be backed up in the evidence, and the plaintiff has the burden to show that it ties in historically or culturally with an understanding that is racial. In the hypothetical you pose, that probably would be an unlikely result that a plaintiff could prevail.
But it has to have a historical background. In other words, the discrimination would have to be going on for a while before it would be actionable under the statute.
Well, not necessarily. If they're developed now, for instance, a notion that French Canadians are racially distinct and there were Klan-like groups who were out to do the sorts of things that happened at Chara Tefila to French Canadians, I don't think we would need to wait for some period of time, but we would need to show that they view their conduct as racially motivated against those groups.
Ms. Brannon, are you asking us, in effect, to equate race with national origin discrimination? Is that what it approaches?
We are not. We are looking to the facts of this case and saying that given the historic and contemporary link in the eyes of people who lash out at Jews that they are a racial group, that we really needn't broach that question in this case at all. But to go back, perhaps...
So long as they're intelligent enough to know that they're not a distinct racial group, it would be okay. They could paint the same things on the synagogue, so long as they know that the Jews are not a separate race.
In this case, Justice
That's
Scalia,
the position you're urging us to take, though, isn't it?
No, I don't think it turns only on admissions. In this case, if the respondents denied up and down that they had a racial belief about Jews, I think...
They in fact didn't. I'm not saying they just admit. They in fact didn't. They in fact know that Jews are not a separate race, but they still set out to defame and cause injury to Jews. Mm-hmm. You think that that would not be covered? So long as the individual is not doing it because he thinks Jews are a separate race.
Well, I have some difficulty, I suppose, with the notion of, you know, they don't think, because given the content of the message that they put up on the walls of Chara Tefila, it really evokes a racist history.
Don't change my hypothetical. I'm giving you a hypothetical in which the individual knows Jews are not a separate race and paints the same things as were painted here on the synagogue. Now, under your theory, if I understand it correctly, that would not be actionable.
Under my theory, I can't reconcile them knowing that Jews are racially distinct and still invoking the Holocaust.
Make believe, all right?
All right.
Just accept my hypothetical. Under your theory, it would not be actionable, isn't that right?
If we could know completely what was in their minds, it would not be actionable. But perhaps to work a variation on your hypothetical.
Well, what in the legislative history supports that very unusual approach to the statute and perhaps unworkable approach?
Well, we think, in fact, that the approach is directly in line with this Court's cases, particularly McDonald and General Building Contractors.
I asked about the legislative history.
And what is supportive in the legislative history was the repeated references.
Well, there may be some support in the legislative history for treating Jews as a separate race or treating Germans as a separate race. But I don't see anything in the legislative history that would make it turn on the relative sophistication of the person doing the discriminating, which you're urging. The view of the discriminator. I mean, that's what gets you into a very peculiar approach here. And is there anything in the legislative history to support that?
Well, Justice O'Connor, we think it isn't so much the sophistication as the intent of the discriminator. And that is an issue that this Court addressed in terms of the legislative history in General Building Contractors and held that intent is the touchstone of coverage, that a plaintiff now has to show racially discriminatory intent.
But why isn't it enough if the intent is to discriminate against a race, as race was understood when the statute was enacted? You're not just insisting that the intent be to discriminate against a race. But you're insisting that the intent be to discriminate against a race because it is a race. Not because we've been at war with Germans for 200 years, but because Germans are a separate race. Now, why do you have to add in that that qualification under the statute? Isn't it enough that you're discriminating against a race? Isn't that all the statutory language would require?
Yes, but the difference, I think, between the last part of what you said and what we're arguing, Justice Scalia, is the motivation of the actor must be racially discriminatory. That is the thing that we are emphasizing.
Why?
Well, because
where is that in the statute?
Well, because this Court so held in General Building Contractors and McDonald that has been the thing that the Court has looked to, not who the group is, who is the victim, but what the intent is, as demonstrated by the acts and by statements and by the usual evidence that fact finders look at to measure intent.
Do you think McDonald would have come out differently if a person just didn't like the color of the white race's skin or of the black race's skin and was discriminating on that ground, although still discriminating against a race?
Well, in our society, skin color is very wrapped up, of course, with issues of race, and I'm not sure that those two things are separable such as McDonald's.
That's what I was wondering about. What would you say if they painted the swastikas on the synagogue on Lenox Avenue in the middle of Harlem? There is a synagogue there.
Yes, Justice Marshall,
and we think... there's not a white person within 10 blocks. Mm-hmm.
And we believe that the result would be the same, that those congregants should be covered, as we believe Shara Tefila would be covered.
Well, you couldn't do it on race, could you?
Again, swastikas on a synagogue, again, invoke that ideology of racial distinctness of Jews. And we think that if that is part
but
of the motivation...
But there are no Jews in that synagogue. There are no white Jews, I would say.
Well, we think it makes no difference whether the Jews are black or white if the racial animus is there to support the cause of action. That, as in McDonald versus Jones, the court hasn't weighed the color of the skin or the race of the victim, but has looked to the intent of the discriminator, and that the result there should be the same even if the victims are black.
But if these people had just vandalized the synagogue without painting anything, swastikas or anything like that, they have just trashed the place. Would you be here?
It would be a much more difficult case.
You would then have to have some other evidence they did it on a racial basis.
Exactly.
But if it turned out that they... And as Justice Scalia suggested, if it turned out that, as a matter of fact, they knew that Jews were not a different race, didn't claim they just didn't like Jews, you wouldn't be here then.
Exactly. If there weren't some evidence, here the character of what was painted is the strongest evidence.
And you would, and in that case, you wouldn't even be here if you determined, or you wouldn't even be here. Even arguably under the statute, claiming that at the time the statute was passed, Jews were considered to be enough different to be covered by the statute.
We might, although I think we would be advocating, as are the respondents in the St. Francis
You don't want to urge in this court, I take it, that the Jews are a different race.
No, not at all, Justice White. We want to urge that where the discrimination against them is racial, even though...
And you don't want it, and you're not urging that Congress thought Jews were a different race at the time they passed the statute?
There is some evidence of that, but we don't really think that that's critical one way or the other to the holding, that what Congress was after and was concerned about was racial discrimination against anyone.
Well, do you think
anyone.
It would be error if we read the legislative history to say Congress thought this that Jews were a different race and therefore the statute covers it? Would we be in error?
No, I don't, although we would certainly urge the court to make clear that, of course, Jews or any other group now bringing a claim would not have to prove some racial distinctness. That was really what was suggested by the Fourth Circuit majority, that there's an extra burden beyond racial motivation on the plaintiff to show that they're non-white or racially distinct, although it's unclear racially distinct from whom. That, we believe, was the crux of the error. And that particular aspect of that opinion, we believe, should be reversed and made clear by the court. Whether or not the court accepts the racial motivation theory that we've put forward or the respondent's approach that is more closely tied to the meaning of race in 1866.
And could, under your theory, these respondents have been prosecuted criminally under the criminal counterpart of these statutes?
We believe that they could. We believe that they could. In fact, they were prosecuted under state law only under the malicious destruction of property types of statutes that don't in any way address the racial motivation or the real the civil rights violation that was the most hurtful part of the conduct. It wasn't really the getting the wall messed up that is offensive to the congregation.
Brandon, you'd have a lot of trouble with the Screws case, which says you must have an intent to deprive somebody of a right, a specific right. Remember that case?
Yes, I do. And we
Well,
think
in this, you'd have an awful lot to prove that criminally, beyond a reasonable doubt.
I think as a question of proof, there will be more or less easy cases. We think that the intent here is very clear and that the right that was violated is the right in Section 1982 to hold property, one of the specifically enumerated rights.
It doesn't say that the result, the man was killed. Screws says it was what was in the man's mind. Mm-hmm. You have to prove that he intended not only to kill, but to kill in order to deny him a constitutional right. Mm-hmm. Well, that would be a lot of problem in this case.
Yeah. It would certainly be a question of fact, but we believe at the threshold a colorable prosecution could be brought.
If your interpretation is correct, do you think that it will eliminate or sweep out of the way some specific exceptions that were enacted in Title VIII of the Housing Act, where Congress specifically exempted some forms of possible discrimination? I guess those would just be swept away by the potential for suit under this section.
Well, as in the Court's prior cases considering the relationship of 1981 in Title VII and 1982 in Title VIII, they're separate and independent causes of action. And the Court already has held that in Title VII and Title VIII, Congress did not intend to abrogate.
Certainly your interpretation, though, would make useless the reservations expressed in Title VIII for certain types of discriminatory conduct.
Well, our view is that Title VIII has its restrictions and its areas of coverage, and that 1982 has its, and that they stand independently. It may well be that there are cases covered under Section 1982 that would not be covered under Title VIII. In fact, this is such a case. We do not have a Title VIII claim because the congregation building is not a dwelling. So the two, we believe, can be on parallel tracks, but each have their independent areas of coverage and exemption.
Well, but it would open up for suit, if you're correct, various things that were reserved in Title VIII. For example, the duplex housing when the owner lives in part of the duplex and that sort of thing.
We think that is true now, Justice O'Connor, under 1982. For example, if a black family is now denied housing, rental housing in a duplex, there's no reason why they cannot bring a Section 1982 case if they can prove that discrimination was against them on racial grounds. It's really we're not going any farther in that area than already the court has established that there are areas of coverage under Section 1982 that might be exempted.
That you would extend it to every other possible source of national origin.
Well, we view it really not as an exemption, but as reversing the Fourth Circuit's attempt to restrict by defining groups the courts think are not racially distinct from the coverage of the statute, whereas under this court's cases, particularly general building contractors, the rule has been where there is racially discriminatory intent, to breach one of the protected rights under the statute, there is coverage.
But Justice O'Connor's point, I think, is that Title VIII has some meaning if you assume that what Title VIII was doing was extending to persons other than just blacks the guarantees of 1982. But now, under your theory, Title VIII doesn't do anything that 1982 doesn't already do.
Well, Title VIII, as I recall, also covers religious discrimination. It also covers, I believe, gender-based discrimination, which our theory certainly would not reach. Racial motivation, we believe, will cover victims of racial motivation, but in a straightforward religious discrimination case, for example, our theory would not cover plaintiffs, whereas Title VIII very well might. So they do have, we believe, their independent areas of coverage and exemption, even under the approach we urge.
Mm-hmm. Can I just explore again what you mean by racial motivation? Suppose a landlord doesn't want a particular racial group just because the landlord thinks that that racial group is sloppy. Just has made the judgment that the group as a whole is sloppy. Now, would that be the racial motivation?
Yes, Justice Scalia, we think it would be. And, in fact, it's those kinds of stereotype generalizations about racial groups that have created the disabilities that Congress was trying to break in the 1866 Act.
But the landlord has to believe that it's a group. If the landlord just believed that, let's say, all Frenchmen are sloppy, but knew that Frenchmen were not a separate racial group, that would be okay.
I don't.
Or let's say all Puerto Ricans or all Italians or whatever. So long as the landlord knows that that's not a racial group, it's perfectly okay.
If it isn't a racially based distinction, we think that case would not be covered.
Very strange.
Harking back to the legislative history a bit, what was at the heart of the Reconstruction Congress's concern, of course, in the first instances was creating situations in which the newly freed slaves could function in our society. But they didn't limit that protection, of course, just to blacks, as the court held in McDonald. It was really a deep concern with racial motivation as being something distinct and particularly odious in our society that was at the heart of their concern.
Seems to me you're only getting at the ill-educated discriminator, right?
Well, perhaps, Justice Scalia, it's a question of ignorance, not education. I think that that there are perhaps those in much more sophisticated places with a string of degrees who may be surprised to hear a congregation arguing before the Supreme Court that Jews are not a race. We believe that the error of the Fourth Circuit simply was in not applying this court's precedents in McDonald and General Building Contractors, but adding on that extra burden and extra test for the plaintiffs. And one of the additional difficulties with that test is that it simply is not practicable and sensible for the district courts to be trying to figure out who is racially distinct or non-white, which are the words that the Fourth Circuit used. It is unclear, first of all, what the court even meant by racially distinct from whom. In Sullivan and Tillman, this court held that even whites who are the victims of racial discrimination by other whites, because those white plaintiffs have advocated the rights of blacks, have a cause of action under Sections 1981 and 1982. And we believe, again, the principle that underlies that case is if the motivation is racial, it's racial because those white plaintiffs were advocating the rights of blacks, that once again there should be a cause of action, even if the plaintiffs and defendants are of the same race, indisputably. In terms, of course, of its language about the Jewish plaintiffs in Shara Tefila being non-white, we think perhaps it goes without saying that it would be a completely inappropriate exercise for the district courts to undertake trying to figure out who is white and non-white in some objective anthropological or scientific test, that simply would not be an appropriate approach for the courts to take. For all of these reasons, we respectfully ask this court to reverse and to hold that all victims of racially motivated deprivations of the rights enumerated in the Civil Rights Act of 1866 may state a cause of action under Sections 1981 and 1982.
Thank you, Ms. Brannon. We'll hear now from you, Mrs. Guerin.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, you have heard the petitioners argue that the desecration of a synagogue, what is a place of worship, is covered by Section 1982, what everyone agrees is a race discrimination statute, because these defendants allegedly acted out of a completely erroneous and irrational belief that Jewish people are racially distinct. I would argue that inclusion of such a religious discrimination claim within the scope of this race discrimination statute is entirely out of keeping with the purpose of the statute as originally enacted and its specific language as interpreted by this Court. Likewise, and particularly importantly, determination of the coverage of Section 1982 wholly by reference to the illogical and erroneous misperceptions of discriminators is a far cry from the purpose and the language of Section 1982 as it has been interpreted by this Court.
Ms. Guerin, there is some evidence in the legislative history, of course, that Congress had in mind treating race to cover such things as gypsies and Chinese and Germans and so forth. Is there not?
There are some general references by some of the legislatures.
And the President,
yes,
President Johnson, vetoed the statute because he thought it was unwise to sweep in Chinese and gypsies, didn't he?
Yes, ma'am. And there are
some there is some legislative history to support the approach that Congress, at least, in enacting Section 1982, may have intended to cover discrimination on the basis of a different version of what constitutes race than we would have today.
I think there is no evidence in the legislative history that Congress intended to define the coverage of the statute wholly by reference to intent. In other words, there is no evidence in the legislative history that the coverage of the statute is determined by whether or not a defendant arguably acted out of an erroneous and illogical racial perception.
That may be true, but how about the argument that apparently is going to be made in the companion case rather than here, that indeed the statute does cover discrimination against Jews because they're Jews?
I would say, Justice O'Connor, that in this case, the petitioners have always very carefully not argued that Jewish people have any sort of racial identity or even are commonly identified by society as racially distinct. They haven't made that argument in this case.
But
now, there may have been some general references in the legislative history to Jewish people as members of a different race. I think it would be inappropriate to look to an individual legislator's comment regarding that as determinative of the coverage of the statute. There's certainly no indication that the majority of Congress.
Well, it would be appropriate, though, to look to the legislative history to determine what it is that Congress had in mind in passing this statute.
Yes, ma'am, and that is what you all have done in determining that the statute is limited to rights which are racial in character and addresses an effort to achieve racial equality with reference to people who are members of specific groups, I think. And whether or not there was a general recognition in society at the time of the 39th Congress that Jews are racially distinct, it's something that's never been argued by petitioners in this case, and I think something that is not evidenced in the legislative history either, and will be difficult to discern if one attempted to go back and develop racial definitions at that time. I would argue that a more appropriate approach would be to try to bring the statute into the 20th century, and at most, in an effort to define what groups are covered, to look at whether a group, an individual is a member of a group that is commonly identified as non-white or is commonly identified as white. That is reflective, I think, of the specific language of the statute and also of the concerns of the legislature.
This Court has brought whites within the protection of the Act in McDonald.
Yes, ma'am.
It's
I understand
unlawful
that.
To discriminate against white people. So
that's
how
right.
Can you now exclude Jews?
Jewish people would have a cause of action based on discrimination because they are white. if that was their contention. But that is not their contention in this case. They also do not contend that they are racially distinct from whites in any way. So I would argue that they do not fall within a group that is protected by the statute. There's no evidence that they fall within such a group.
Mrs. Garin, the problem we have in the United States, I say a problem, is perhaps a great asset of our country, is that we have so many different races that over a period of many years there have been a great many intermarriages. We have a heterogeneous society. How would your theory fit, for example, if a white had married an Asian and their progeny, children, grandchildren, would they be a member of the white race or an Oriental race? You could cite any number of examples like that. We see them every day. We have friends like that. What do we do about that?
Your Honor, I'm not attempting to suggest that the court define scientific categories of race, as has been suggested by the petitioners. I think what you would do with those sorts of cases is, first of all, there are certain groups in our society that are commonly identified as non-white. Those groups would be entitled to protection. And if an individual is subjected to discrimination because he is perceived to be a member of such a group, then he would be covered.
That's a matter of perception?
It is a perception only of an individual's membership in a group that is commonly identified as non-white. And that is something that the jury could determine. In other words, whether or not that individual was acted against because he was non-white.
Does that bring you close to the position of your opposition here today?
No, I think it does not, because the petitioner argues that the perceptions of the discriminator without reference to groups are determinative. In other words, under the petitioner's argument, to take an extreme example, if a group of anti-gay people decided that homosexuals were racially different than others and discriminated against them on that basis, I think carrying the petitioner's argument to its logical conclusion, that claim would be covered by the statute. The same might be true for handicapped individuals. Suppose some deviant organization in our society decided that handicapped people were different racially and acted against them on that basis. I believe that claim also would be covered under the petitioner's theory for the coverage of the statute. So it is something different. It's an effort to bring the statute into the 20th century and to recognize racial groups in a way with reference to society's perceptions.
Where do you want to go to find this, to read it, if you are part Scandinavian, part Indian, part South African, part Japanese? What are you? What book do you find?
Again, Your Honor, I'm not saying that anyone has to make that determination. I'm saying that there only has to be a decision by a jury whether you were discriminated against because you're identified
as
non-white.
Or non-white.
Pardon me?
You said you have to find out whether you're white or non-white. Did you say that?
No, sir, I did not say that.
I
said that an individual could obtain the coverage of this statute if he was discriminated against because he is identified as non-white. He's a member of a group that is commonly identified as non-white.
How do you become identified as a non-white person?
Well, I think one obvious way in which you'd be identified as a non-white person would be by reference to immutable physical characteristics such as skin color, which is what we traditionally understand.
I would like to have seen you identify my father. He was white with blonde hair and blue eyes.
In that case, sir, I don't think that he would have a cause of action for race discrimination because a fact finder could not determine
that. Oh,
but
he did. He was a Negro. He knew that. I'm trying to find where you do. What do you do with Sammy Davis?
Sammy Davis might certainly have a cause of action for race discrimination. He would not have a cause of action based on his
people
religion.
People that committed this act knew exactly what they were doing, and they knew exactly who they were aiming at, didn't they?
Your Honor, I understand that this was an egregious wrong.
and should
and that
be punished.
It's one that cries out for a remedy. That is correct. And there was a remedy here available to these petitioners.
What?
Mr. Reamer was convicted of malicious destruction of property and was sentenced to 3 years, the maximum sentence for that offense. Criminal restitution was available to the petitioners under Maryland law. In addition, they had many common law actions that they could have brought in the state courts. Instead, they asserted them as pendant claims in the federal court and never really seriously wanted to pursue those state claims because they wanted to send a message to these individuals under federal civil rights law. And my point simply is that you can only send that message if Congress has accorded federal jurisdiction to do it, and that there's no indication that Congress intended this statute's coverage to be determined by reference to individual discriminators' illogical and irrational perceptions of race.
Mr. Garen, there has to be something more.
There is such a thing as an Ethiopian Jew, isn't there?
Yes, sir.
Suppose this synagogue had been one for Ethiopian Jews.
That might be a different case, Your Honor. I can imagine a circumstance where there could be allegations that the synagogue was defaced because its members were predominantly black, in which case, clearly, they would be able to assert a claim under Section 1982.
Black, not Jewish, then?
That's correct. That's correct. Because they have agreed that Jewish people are not racially distinct.
They're black and Jewish.
I think they have a cause of action because they are black.
But no court
has ever indicated.
If they pointed swastikas, they wouldn't have a cause of action because they're Jewish.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You have to take that position.
In order to take that position, you would have to. Yes, sir, I do. You'd have to define the scope of the coverage of this statute, something clearly that Congress and now the courts must do, by reference to those deviant organizations' decisions about Jewish racial identity. The petitioners herein do not claim a Jewish racial identity and have never claimed a Jewish racial identity, nor do they contend that they are commonly identified as racial or non-white in any sense. Simply a matter of what this statute was intended to address. It was not, I would argue, a statute to root out all forms of invidious discrimination or bigotry in our society. This court has held that it does not address sex discrimination, religious discrimination, national origin discriminations, standing alone. And all of those categories would be pulled in, arguably, under the petitioner's theory.
Are you taking the position, however, that the statute is applicable only to blacks?
No, sir, I am not.
So if it were Chinese, you'd say the statute is applicable?
That is correct. That group would be members.
And yet, when the statute was enacted, the concern was with the freedmen, was it not?
Well, if one looks to the actual concern of the legislatures in passing this statute, I think one would have to realize that it was passed in an effort to protect and extend the rights of the newly freed slaves. And this court has indicated, therefore, that blacks are protected, and has subsequently indicated that whites as well are protected. The additional step that you must take, not in my case, I would argue, because in this case, Jewish petitioners have indicated that they do not have a racial identity, but in the case that follows mine, there's a need to make an effort to define race. And I would argue that the petitioners just throw that out the window and say we don't need to define it. We don't need to determine what groups are protected by this statute. We'll determine the statute's coverage by reference to each individual's deviant ideas without any reference to protected groups in our society.
May I ask, Ms. Garen, over the years ago, of course, still prevalent in some areas, there was prejudice against Jews. It was known in our society. There was a lot of anti-Semitism. How would you characterize that prejudice?
Your Honor, I would.
You wouldn't call it racial prejudice.
As prejudice that is based on their religion.
You think it was
because
based
that
entirely
is the,
on their
that
religion.
Is the characteristic that defines them. There is no racial characteristic that, in fact, defines people of the Jewish faith. It is a religion.
You think that was would be the proper characterization in Germany when it was so virulent?
No, sir. But again, that was the deviant perception of a couple of organizations in the society that had run rampant. It wasn't a common perception in society. They weren't commonly identified.
You think the origin of the prejudice in this country was entirely religious?
Of the prejudice against Jewish people?
Yes.
I think I am not qualified to comment on that, but I have every reason to believe that religion in part motivated that prejudice, because that is what, in fact, defines the group.
It didn't extend to Jews who were atheists, non-believers? You really think that was the case?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Justice Scalia.
I mean, you think the prejudice that existed against Jews in this country was only against believing Jews? And so long as the Jews said, I really no longer believe in the religious tenets of Judaism, the prejudice no longer exists, and that person would have been able to get into all sorts of country clubs and whatnot?
No, sir. But I do think that the discriminators identify the group by their religious beliefs. They may not know in each individual instance whether that Jewish person follows his faith or not.
Why? You want us to use modern concepts of taxonomy in order to apply this statute.
No, I don't think I do, Why? Your Honor. I don't think I do. I am not suggesting that you attempt to define racial categories in a taxonomical fashion or any kind of scientific way, because I do think that there are incredible difficulties with doing that. I'm saying that
modern perceptions. Modern perceptions is what you want us
common,
to use.
The common identification of a group as non-white in our society. And that's an approach that the lower courts have taken without fail in attempting to grapple with these cases. And none of those lower courts have included Jewish people within the rubric of
why just statute. Why just non-white? I mean, wasn't non-white, do you contest that non-white was used in the statute to mean non-Anglo-Saxon?
I mean,
isn't there a lot in the legislative history that would suggest that Germans would have been considered non-white for purposes of this statute?
There may be statements by individual legislators that, with reference to a German race, now whether that individual legislator considered Germans to be non-white, I don't know. I have no reason to think that the legislature intended to address the rights of Germans when it passed this race discrimination statute.
Wasn't there a lot in the legislative history that showed that the statute was a reaction not just to slavery, but also to the know-nothingism that had grown up in this country, and that it was intended to protect Irish and Germans in particular?
The respondents in the case that follows us have discussed some of those references. I do not think there was a lot in the legislative history to that effect, nor do I think that that would represent the majority opinion of the legislator. I think the primary emphasis was on protecting the rights of newly freed slaves and blacks in the South when that statute was passed. It was a Reconstruction-era statute. And the courts have now extended it, you all have now extended it, to encompass whites. The question is how one defines additional categories that it would cover. And I think it's with reference to those two categories that one defines the definition.
Ms. Karen, do you want us to amend McDonald and say when we said white people, we didn't mean Jews?
No, sir. I think, again, that Jewish people have a cause of action based on their whiteness. If they're discriminated against because they're white, they can sue. If a Jewish person is discriminated against because he's black, he can sue. Jewish people don't have a racial identity, as the petitioners have recognized, as the lower courts have recognized, as we recognize. They have a cause of action.
That's how you get out of McDonald's.
I don't see a problem with McDonald's.
Just because certain Jews are white in complexion doesn't take away the rights of them as Jews.
Those are rights against religious discrimination. There's no Jewish people are racially distinct.
Well, this is not religious discrimination then. Here.
I would say this is religious discrimination and is not encompassed within this race discrimination.
That's the only thing the swastika means.
A synagogue was desecrated.
For the Jews. That's what swastika means.
I appreciate what Nazis believed, and I also think
that is not
a belief that is common to society.
I didn't say Nazis. I said anybody that uses the swastika means death to the Jews. German, American, or whoever he is, you don't use the swastika.
Well, I think even the petitioners in this case would agree that a claim would not be covered if the swastika wasn't used to indicate that Jews are racially inferior. That's what results from their standard.
Well, whether it's racially inferior or not, it means that you should die.
Pardon me?
It means that you should die.
These are horrible views. The question is whether or not we should determine federal jurisdiction by them.
The word is Holocaust.
I understand that Jewish people have been subjected to historical discrimination, that it's an awful circumstance. But whereas here, these petitioners were not without a remedy to make them whole, there isn't any need to extend a federal statute to cover any situation where a defendant acted out of a misperception.
How could they protest the swastika being placed on their building?
Well, I think, first of all, that they could have pursued these fellows in state court.
Well, if they say that, if you just painted a stroke, you're desecrating the building.
That's true, Your Honor.
Well, this was more than that. This was a swastika.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I think that the state courts likewise would have addressed that circumstance.
Well, what statute does the state have to say you shall not use swastikas?
State doesn't have such a statute,
right,
Your Honor. However, I think the egregious nature of the conduct in this case would have been addressed by reference to punitive damages, for instance, in common law actions, by reference to criminal restitution, by reference to sentencing. And I think it was. With respect to criminal sentencing, at least with respect to the individual whom I represent, he received the maximum sentence, and that is an uncommon thing for malicious destruction of property in the state of Maryland. That reflects an effort by the state to address the seriousness of the act. Your Honor, I don't know the circumstances surrounding the others. It's not part of the record, and I have no way of knowing whether there is even sufficient proof to tie them in with this incident.
Ms. Guerin, you rely on the fact that it was a synagogue that to show that it was racial, or religious rather than racial, but actually they just went across the street to the synagogue after they had initially spray painted a drug fair, right, which is not notably religious.
And that's correct.
And they had sprayed the drug fair with the words white power and Aryan Brotherhood. And then after that, they happen to see a synagogue, and they go over and do what they did to the synagogue.
That's
it doesn't
correct.
Strike me as predominantly religious, the whole episode.
No one has denied, at least for purposes of this appeal, that these defendants acted out of a belief that Jews are racially inferior and that the symbols they painted suggested that.
Well, then I don't understand why you raised the fact that it was a synagogue and saying that that proves something about the case. I don't see that.
What happens when if the court applies this misperception standard, to use a shortened term, then in essence all religious discrimination claims, national origin discrimination claims, even some sex discrimination claims might come within this race discrimination statute. That's the point that I'm trying to make when I say that this is really religious discrimination. And it's an effort to use a standard that will result in an unmanageable approach to the statute, I think, in the lower courts, and one that is not consonant with the purpose of the statute as originally enacted and with its language. The problem is with the standard that the petitioners urge and the results that could accrue if that standard is applied. I don't think in this case it really isn't necessary that you engage in this racial definition that we've been hassling with, because the petitioners indicate that they are not racially distinct and Jewish people are not racially distinct. And recognizing that, they have attempted to argue that the perceptions of the individual defendants, erroneous and irrational perceptions, are what determine the coverage of a federal civil rights statute. That just can't be right. There's no evidence that that is what determines the coverage of the statute in the legislative history.
What if I just disagree with them as to whether they're racially distinct within the meaning that the framers of the statute had? Framers who thought the gypsies were a race, who thought the Germans were a race, who meant by race a stock.
I understand. It would be my position that the petitioners have essentially stipulated that away here,
They have never contended that Jews are racially distinct or commonly identified as such, nor do they want that characterization.
Do you think it wouldn't be within our power, given the status of the case, to decide it on that basis?
Clearly it would be within your power. I think that it would be...
An
inappropriate... I think that it would be an inappropriate interpretation of the statute. It would result in you having to reach back to the 1860s and determine what groups society then regarded as racially distinct, and I don't think that's a practical approach to interpreting the statute. And a more appropriate approach, I think, is to look to our society now and to look what, to determine what groups are commonly identified as non-white with reference to what we all recognize as racial characteristics.
Why not non-white? What groups are identified as races? Well, what if we concluded that the theory of these people was scientifically foolish, but not necessarily socially foolish? That there are a lot of people who might use the term Jewish to refer to what they think is a racial group, a stock.
I think that the petitioners would disagree that there's any kind of common perception. I understand, Your Honor.
Has that been conceded away, too, that there's no common perception? I don't recall any. I do recall their forcefully arguing that they are not scientifically, Jews are not scientifically a race, but I don't recall their arguing that there is no general social perception that to be a Jew is only a religious thing.
I think that they have never indicated that there is a common perception in our society today that Jews are racially distinct either.
May I ask, is it critical to your case that there be some well-defined categories of races? I imagine at one time, perhaps scientists might have thought there were 5 or 6 races or 10 or 20. Now they seem to say there are 3, is it? 3 races. What if 20 years from now they really studied this thing out and determined there's only 1 race? Really the differences among the races are not scientifically significant.
Yes,
then I suppose the statute would just no longer have any significance.
That is why I would take the position that it isn't appropriate to define races by reference to any kind of scientific terminology. In fact, an appropriate approach is the approach that anthropologists take.
How, if you don't do it by reference to scientific standards, what are the standards for defining whether two people are in different races or not?
The approach that, in fact, anthropologists take in many instances is by reference to culture and by reference to common perceptions in society.
Well, if you look at culture, I suppose a pretty strong argument could be made that the Jewish have a very special culture of their own.
No, I do not believe a strong argument could be made that the Jewish people are commonly identified as racially different. That's what I'm referring to when I say that cultural
what I'm trying to get at is
define race.
How does one decide whether two people are in the same or different races?
One evaluates whether those individual, you look at the individual, first of all, and you evaluate whether that individual is identified as white or is identified as non-white in our society in some sense.
So now we've got two races, white and non-white. Those are we're down to 2, is that it?
There are various groups that would fall in the non-white category. This is in an effort to get at defining what race means.
In your view,
would racial groups would be protected?
How about Hispanics and Arabs? Would they fit in your category?
I think it's quite conceivable that Hispanics would be a group that's commonly identified as non-white in our society, and several of the lower circuit courts have held that and have approached the statute in precisely the way that I'm suggesting that you approach.
And how about Muslims or Arabs?
Muslims is a religious term, I believe. Again, it would require the courts to evaluate whether there's a common identification of that group as racially distinct or non-white in our society. For my individual reaction, I think that those groups would be included within the categories that are protected because in many instances, individuals that are in those groups have dark skin, for example. And there can be no doubt that if an individual is discriminated against because he is black and has dark skin, or if a large number of members of that group are black and have dark skin, they would have a cause of action under this statute. Well, in conclusion, I would like to say that where, as here, there are adequate state remedies available to the petitioners, it's not necessary to stretch Section 1982 to cover every defendant's
every defendant who is motivated by an irrational and erroneous racial perception. And therefore, I would ask the lower courts to uphold this court to uphold the lower court's dismissal of this claim for the desecration of a synagogue under Section 1982. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Guerin. Ms. Brannon, you have 1 minute remaining.
May it please the Court, if I could just briefly address the issue that arose during Mrs. Guerin's argument about commonness of the perception of Jews and whether this is a deviant belief. First of all, as Judge Wilkinson pointed out in dissent below, there was no record on the commonness of the belief because we were cut off on a motion to dismiss in which the district court didn't even consider the extra pleading material that we put in the record. But secondly, that I think that some Gallup poll or test of the prevalence of the view really doesn't solve the problem. The facts of this case show that this kind of conduct occurs. It is not unique to Shara Tefila, and where it occurs, regardless of the prevalence or whether we characterize it as deviant, which I hope we all would, that the harm is the same. It is a harm based on racially motivated conduct, and it should be redressed under Section 1982.
Thank you, Ms. Brannon. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument.